In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Stevens Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be chatting with Crispian Mills presently. He's a frontman, lead singer, and lead guitarist in the UK band Coolest Shaker. Originally active back in the 1990s, they've had a hiatus or two, but they're back this year with a new album, First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs, which features a recent coolest song in the world, Whatever It Is, I'm Against It. We hear a bit of that now, followed by my talk with Crispian on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and joining me today for our coolest conversations is Crispian Mills, lead singer and guitarist in the British band Coolest Shaker. Their latest album is First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs, and our coolest song of the world this week, Whatever It Is, I'm Against It, is from it. Hi, Crispian, how are you?
Hello, Manfred. Pleasure to be here. It's very exciting.
Well, thank you for joining me. Man, your family background, pretty cool here. Performing arts, very prevalent in the family tree. Your mother, Haley Mills, the actress. Over here, we know her mainly as a child actress in a bunch of Disney movies, including The Parent Trap. And your grandfather, actor Sir John Mills. Your father, filmmaker Roy Boulting, Richard Attenborough, Lawrence Oliver, friends of the family. You know, as a kid being raised in that environment, you know, you wouldn't think that anything is unusual or appear out of the ordinary. But looking back now, what sorts of things or memories stand out that make you realize what a unique experience you had as a child?
Absolutely. You grow up and you just think, well, all of the family, I mean, so many of them are actors. My father was a filmmaker, so he was behind the camera. But, you know, yeah, it's only slow later on that you kind of start to put two and two together and appreciate that something slightly wrong here. Well, I think we all realize, at some point we realize our family has got problems, but it's the setting, isn't it, that you actually take in. You think, well, it's about growing up in public, and that's what my mum had to do. And I was kind of spared that. I was shielded to quite an extent from that kind of public family upbringing. It wasn't like, wasn't quite so extreme. So the worst of it I avoided, thankfully. But as I've grown up, I look back and appreciate, you know, that's the kind of work they do. It's just a strange job, a silly job, you might say.
Well, I've read that you were exposed to a wide variety of music as a youth, and that your grandfather even used to sing cowboy songs to you at bedtime. Can you recall which ones, what songs he sang to you?
Well, it's all part of a strange dream. I'm not sure how much of it is real and how much of it I dreamt up, but there was a few, you know, there was a I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande. That was the one that used to put me off to sleep. But it was very musical childhood. My father wrote and he played piano. It was pretty good blues, jazz blues. You know, he loved the kind of Oscar Peterson kind of school. Yeah. And wasn't mad about modern jazz. I think one of the last things he said actually before he died was, you know, I really resent Charlie Parker. It's a hell of a statement to make at the end of your life. But you know, he wrote music for his films, and so it was always around. And but I didn't really become obsessed with music until I was a teenager, and I became a full-time guitar worshiper.
Well, about that, I was wondering, you know, you've got all sorts of music in the home. You're explaining there about your dad too. What was there any epiphany or one moment that set you off on your life's music journey?
Yeah, it was because, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and you know, there was a lot of good music, a lot of good songs being written in the 80s, but a lot of it was kind of overshadowed by type of sort of digital production. And it wasn't until, you know, I started getting into like really retro music at quite a young age. And I remember the first time in my life that I heard You Really Got Me by the Kinks. You know, and it might have been an old song by the time I heard it, but for me it was fresh and new. And when I heard it, it was very, very loud as well. Somebody played it really loud, and everything stopped. And it was like, you know, Saul on the road to Damascus. And, you know, I suddenly realized, wow, that, what is that? I want to know. This is music I've not heard before. And it was the guitar, it was the energy of the band. And then I just became obsessed with, especially with, you know, that kind of electric music, and the fact that you could play it yourself, if, you know, struggle for a few weeks and then you'd get your first chords and you'd be able to play it. And so I was already living in a time warp when I was at high school. I was already living in the 60s by then, and everyone else, I was a freak, you know. And so I've never really gotten to that age where, you know, you get old and you say, oh, kids these days and music's not what it used to be in my day. But I was already saying that when I was, you know, 15.
I like the way you describe yourself as being a freak, because here in the Underground Garage, we accept you, one of us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
It's good to be with you. There's a lot of love in this room, I can tell.
Yeah. So how old were you then here? You're here in the Kinks. So you were a teenager, right?
Yeah, I was about 13.
13. And were you already playing guitar at that point, or this was the inspiration to start playing guitar?
Yeah, I had wanted to play saxophone. And, you know, my mom had said, you got to prove yourself. So you're going to start on the recorder and then, you know, the whistle, and then you're going to have to work your way up to clarinet. And then if you prove yourself on clarinet, then I might get you a saxophone. So eventually I got to saxophone, and within, you know, 6 months, I heard the Kinks, and that, and then I just wanted to play guitar. So it was a bit of a sharp turn into another.
Well, you start playing guitar. Did you start trying to play with other kids or form a band when you were still in your teens?
Yeah, straight away, you know, coming up with band names, and that's all part of it. You know, my kids, actually, they play. I've got my youngest kids, 11 and 14, and they both play drums and guitar, and they've got friends. And before they had any songs, you know, they had some really cool photos. You know, they look really great, and that that's half of it. You know, it's an attitude, and you know, it's this thing about electric guitar, drums, and, you know, that music, rock and roll, whatever you want to call it, it's a hit. It's an attitude. And, you know, people, I remember when I was, you know, at school and people were writing it off saying, oh, it's finished, it's over, you know, it's going to be all, you know, it's gone acid house now. And that was the thing at the time. People were talking about acid house and rave music. And I know that, you know, 10 years before that, they'd say disco was killing it, you know, and it just keeps coming back because it's an attitude that just won't die. It's too good. And people just keep wanting to, you know, plug in.
Well, so you got the Kinks starting you off with the guitar way. Oh, Dave. So Dave Davies, have you ever met Dave Davies?
No, I've not met Dave. I've not met Ray Davies. But I did speak to Chrissy Hynde about them because she was married to Ray Davies.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, half the reason she married him, she really loved the Kinks.
Well, you know, they supposedly met after she had covered, I think it was Stop Your Sobbing, that he'd found out that she had covered that. And,
it's not a basis for a long lasting marriage.
No. So you've
she
got
said
this,
they used to, they, right. they Sorry. Well, she was telling me that, you know, they Dave and Ray used to fight like anything, you know, as brothers. And because I was telling my kids, because obviously their brothers playing in a band together. And I said, oh, you know, so many great bands have got brothers and they fight. And that's part of the creative tension. And I think when bands really, really work, there is a sense of family. And certainly with Kula Shaker, we've known each other since we were kids, and it feels much more like a family than a bunch of guys just playing music.
Well, in fact, I wanted to ask you about Alonzo Bevan, your bass player, because you guys were actually playing together before Kula Shaker formed. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we used to, we played when we were at college or high school, as you call it. And, you know, we tried to set up a psychedelic nightclub near our school. And we found a room at the back of an ice rink, up on the top floor at the back of an ice rink. It was an old Victorian building. And, you know, we had, I think from like 7:30 till 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, you could go, and we just covered the room in psychedelic lights. We had this local guy who came and would put up all these crazy oil lights and fill the room with smoke and bubble machines. And there was nowhere to go around there for kids, especially from the high school, nowhere. And suddenly there was this psychedelic oasis. with bands and it was really hard. We had to carry all the PA up these three flights of stairs, and it was completely impractical, but we managed to keep it going for about 6 months before, you know, we collapsed with exhaustion and debt. But it was a good, you know, you got to suffer for your art, and if there's nowhere to play, then you got to create your own in your own venue, which is that's why we did that.
So Kula Shaker formed around about 1995, the psychedelic ice rink disco, that club that predates that. When about was that?
Well, it was earlier. We were at school together, and then I went off to India, and I had to kind of consummate my sort of spiritual path. You know, I was really very much wanting to go and do that pilgrim thing. And I did. And, you know, it's one thing to read about India and to even read about philosophy but to actually go there and travel, visit the holy places. And it was a really powerful experience. So I came back, I was all fired up and ready to, take on the music business. So that was around 93, and it took us about 2 years to get a record deal. And at the end of 1995, we managed to get a deal and one that we actually, you know, kept. We got a deal for about 6 months in that preliminary period, but we got dropped and dumped quite quickly, because our manager at the time was sending the record head poetry. Instead of a memo or a request for a new amp, she'd send him a poem, and he just had enough of it. So we, but by the time we, you know, by the time we got signed up by Columbia Records, we were ready to take on the business, and we had the right manager at the right time and the right songs, and Britpop was boiling over as well into. Right. It didn't know what it was anymore. It was just sort of like Lager and Oasis were battling Blur, and it was starting to eat itself, you know, because it was all about just sort of like having a good time and being proud of being British. But why? What were you actually saying? It wasn't really saying much, and so it was starting to implode. And then we came along with this whole. You know, we're transcending being British because it's about the kind of global scene. It's about India and it's about magic. It's about spirituality. It's about America and rock and roll and freedom. And so we were really mixing it up, and it was a really good moment for us. We really felt like we were there at the right time.
And well, you had several very successful albums, singles in the UK, a couple of hiatuses ensued. And now you're back.
Oh, yeah.
The album, First Congregational Church. What's that?
Yeah, yeah. I kind of retired by the time I was 25. I'd semi-retired and kind of gone in, you know, there's success in the music business is quite traumatic, you know, for most people. And we ended up kind of basically disbanding and then coming back about 5 years later and setting up our own label and just sort of starting to rebuild our independence. And it was really hard. It took a long time. And I've made a couple of films in the meantime, and Alonzo's been producing. But it really felt with this album like we'd sort of coming full circle, actually. And the band was kind of being reborn. Reincarnated, perhaps, is a better term.
Well, there you go. That ties into to the spirituality and Hinduism. Let's talk for a moment about our coolest song in the world this week. Whatever it is, I'm against it. Maybe this one leans more Deep Purple than Ray Davies. What inspired the tune?
I'll tell you what inspired it is my kids were watching the Marx Brothers.
And well, I'm laughing right before we were speaking, Dennis, he said, how about you're going to ask him about the Marx Brothers, right? And I completely, totally didn't catch that. And and so then right before you were on, we're talking about what our favorite Marx Brothers songs are, movies are. But yes, so your sons. We're watching a Marx Brothers film.
We got a beautiful Blu-ray box set of the Marx Brothers in the Paramount years, and this is before, you know, they got really polished. And basically, the Marx Brothers, their whole formula was you get a movie, you create like a normal plot, some normal characters, and then you have the Marx Brothers invade the movie and just trash it. And they trash it to the point where there's no movie left and it just has to end. There's no punchline, there's no resolution of storyline. It's just broken, and they walk away from the wreckage and the titles go up. And what the Marx Brothers did, they had this strange ditty called I'm Against It in a movie called Horse Feathers. And it was just that lyric, whatever it is, I'm against it, that Groucho sings. It's so irreverent. It's because, you know, when the Marx Brothers came out, that was the Depression. It was the Wall Street crash. And it was such a cathartic thing to see these guys just make fun of all of those figures of authority, whether it was, you know, the rich, the bankers, the, you know, those people, you know, institutions, hallowed institutions like the police, everybody, they just took the Mickey out of them. And because It was really needed. And I think it felt very much like now, in the sense that everyone is really suffering, basically. And the people who caused all the damage, they're not touched by all this. And it's exactly the same as it was in the 30s. The people who caused the collapse of everything, they're still up there on the top floor in their penthouse suites, and everybody else is left to deal with the aftermath. And the Marx Brothers had this fantastic satire and humor, which was so cathartic. And I just wanted to do something with that lyric, and felt really good. And also, you know, in this time where you know everyone is told they have to pick a side, and everybody has to be pro this or anti that, and it's just like, you know, I just love the kind of whatever it is, I'm against it. You know, I'm not taking anyone's side. I'm against everything.
So when did you where and when did you record the track, and did you record it with the album? Was all this done at the same time or piecemeal?
Yeah, well, I'm Against It was the first thing we recorded for the album. I just was starting to get ideas together, and I had that lyric. I wanted to use that lyric, and so I just wanted to just do some heavy electric blues, and we went and recorded it in a day. And I think we put it out straight away just to for our fans, so that they knew we were serious. We actually were recording, because when you take 4 years to make a record, people want to know you're serious. They don't, our fans don't always believe it. Say, oh yeah, they're in the studio. Oh yeah. Well, how many more years is it going to before we hear something? So we wanted to show them we were, you know.
Well, my notes say that you and Alonzo produced the recordings. Is that correct?
Yeah. We've become very self-sufficient.
Yeah.
And we have a studio in Belgium, and I think it ultimately makes your albums more personal.
Well, you guys have been in a music marriage for such a long while. Do you finish each other's sentences even when you're not doing music?
Yeah, there's definitely a kind of a brain meld going on, or brain mold, depends what time of the day it is. But we, you know, we've learned from the best. You know, we've worked with people like Bob Ezrin and George Trakoulis, Rick Rubin, John Leckie. You know, it's been great to get to a point where you get to apply all your own experience. And maybe the next record will work with someone else. You know, you there's a certain sort of objectivity that you have to watch out for if you're doing it yourself. But for us, it's just so nice to be able to just, if we're ready, we'll just go in and do it. We don't have to wait for somebody to become available, or, you know, so it's just it's all happening in-house.
That tune, Farewell Beautiful Dreamer, has got some really great lyrics, a bit of a Ray Davies sort of lilt, including the line about ghosts of Iroquois braves. On the album, there's also songs, Where Have All the Brave Knights Gone, The Once and Future King. I read that, I don't know if this is true, I just read this, that as a child, you saw your grandfather as sort of a literal knight, like one that was liable to suit up in armor. Does he play into any of those songs?
I think it's just a sort of, I think, you know, everybody's imagination is forged in the early years, right? And so we see the world through a lens. You know, our dreams and our imagination is really kind of built in those formative years, I guess, you know, up until you're five or six. I mean, that's where all the damage gets done. So music that you've heard or films that you've seen even I think plays a big part. But I think, you know, like when someone says your granddad's a knight, and he has got a sir by his name. And he, you know, he, for him, it was for his services to the industry, because he was, you know, he, I think he got knighted because he, after he got the Oscar for a film called Ryan's Daughter. Mm. And it was, you know, the Brits love it when they go and, you know, do well abroad, especially in somewhere like America, you know, so such a big deal. So they love a conquering Brit.
But right. You know, especially he over the former colonies, I guess. But
yeah. So but he didn't have some paraphernalia around. Like, he had a sword that had been given to him by famous naval costumers in Savile Row called Jeeves and Hawkes, who designed, you know, famous military uniform suppliers, and, you know, go back as far as Lord Nelson and the Battle of Trafalgar, and they'd supplied him with a sword and on his birthday, and there were a few sort of bits of, you know, artifacts and paraphernalia around that left an impression as a young child and scarred the mind. And then you think, oh, but actually I just remember him as being, you know, my granddad. He was a real sweetheart, and he was completely unpretentious. He just loved what he did. And that's really my lasting memory of him, as a guy who liked to play the piano and loved cars as well. I was always really fascinated by what someone was driving. Was very impressed with the big engine he was.
Well, another tune I enjoy greatly off the long player is Gingerbread Man. You know, a lot of soul and R&B songs are good to draw on nursery rhymes and imagery. You know, and I've always thought that's great, because it's an excellent way to connect with people. Why did the Gingerbread Man resonate with you?
Well, it's I was Alonzo's lyric, actually. He wrote possibly the most complicated song ever put to paper, and he sent it to me, and I did a little bit of work on it, and it ended up becoming even more complicated. I think every chord that exists is in there somehow. But it doesn't sound complicated when you listen to it. It's only when you try to play it that you realize, oh my God, how many chords do you need in one song?
Only one if you're James Brown.
Yeah, I know, exactly. I know. Come on. Simplify to amplify.
Yeah.
You know, all those nursery rhymes, they again, you know, they speak in a language that's the language of the unconscious. And, you know, we all kind of feel a connection to the Gingerbread Man. You know, mum and dad, intentionally or unintentionally, are sealing your doom. You have to escape. And once you do, you know, once you do escape, and then you're out on your own, and you need to beware, because there's some bad people out there. And I think that is the motto of the Gingerbread Man story, is don't be a slave to fear, and, you know, break free. But at the same time, you know, keep one eye open, because there really are foxes.
Clever foxes.
Gobble you up. Clever foxes, cunning.
Yeah. 108 ways to leave your narcissist. That's drawn from experience?
Yeah, you know, narcissism has become a bit of a buzzword, I don't know how many people know really what a narcissist is. And when you dig into it, you realize, oh my God, narcissists, they're everywhere. I mean, I've had some terrible experiences with people, and I realize why. It's because I'm dealing with a narcissist, and somebody very close to me found themselves married to one. And it wasn't until the marriage broke down that he realized that it was a narcissistic personality disorder. And then you get into, how does that work? And it's, you know, it's anyway, I think it's all part of, there's a book that I heard about, something called something like, thank you so much for being such a pain. you know, it's like people are sent to teach us about ourselves, you know, and yeah. the narcissist actually ultimately is going to teach you about your own self-worth. Because if you get trapped in a relationship with a narcissist, it's because you've allowed them to, because you don't, you know, the part of you is a masochist. So, that song is, it sounds quite whimsical, but it was born of a lot of suffering.
Mm. Well, you know, one thing is interesting about how you, the songs are presented as the album, you've got them interspersed with bits of a church service. Who came up with the idea of that, presenting the album in that fashion, interspersing the songs with the bits of this service?
Oh, it was a sort of last minute thing where we were, you know, assembling the album. And at one point we thought we were going to whittle everything down to 12 songs. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that it should be a double album, because we'd cut away from 20 or 17 down to 12, and there was too much blood on the floor. So as we started to rebuild it, we thought, look, maybe we could find something to give it a bookend, you know. And then that turned into the church, and this idea of the war in heaven, you know, that's reflected on earth, and that the fall of Lucifer and the defeat of evil, you know, that's what manifests, you know, on earth is actually taking place in the heavens. And I kind of got into that idea and just had a lot of fun with it, you know, because ultimately, you know, that's an old English vicar. And we love the idea that, you know, he's talking about this lofty, epic concept of St. Michael fighting Lucifer in heaven. And yet, you know, basically there's a hole in the roof and it's leaking on people's heads, and, you know, everyone's got coughs, and it brings
and the
it down
cell
to
phones
earth.
Are the cell phones yeah. are going off, and yeah. and so there was a funny bit there. The I guess it's the choir director. She speaks, and I couldn't quite catch if she was. There's a leak coming from the roof. And she's figured out who she thinks is responsible for the leak. What is she saying
yeah,
exactly?
She's busting the kids for nicking the lead guttering off the roof.
And, that's it, the lead guttering. Okay.
She's on their trail, and she's going to hunt them down and find
out. She always gets her man, Crispin. Yeah.
It's the idea
please go ahead.
Well, she just sounds like a very meek and mild choir mistress / Sunday school teacher, but, you know, she's actually the Punisher.
So this phrase that the vicar uses, not on your Nelly, I have never had to look that up. I mean, so in the context, I thought, you know, well, I got the gist of it, but I had to look it up to make sure.
No, that's good. That's good. If we have one American, if we just have one American Googling not on your Nelly, then we've done something good.
A job well done. Job well done. Okay, so new album out, and I know you've played some shows this year. Any plans to tour the U.S. at all upcoming?
I certainly hope so. We've always had a great time playing in the States, and anyone who plays this kind of music, you know, it's kind of like playing in America is a mecca, and so look forward to doing it again soon. We want to play all over. I know it's been talked about, so we'll have to see. Fingers crossed.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed sometime soon. Wanted to ask you about the song you covered back in 97, do a version of Hush, the song Joe South had written for Billy Joe Royal, and then Deep Purple, you know, had the bigger hit, and you guys had a sizable hit with it in the UK. Tell me about your love for Deep Purple. You dig those guys a lot. They come kind of feel that vibe in, and at least on this record, I can pick it up on it.
I mean, Richie Blackmore was the first guitar player that I worshipped. Before Hendrix, before, Jimmy Page or Eric Clapton, that was the first proper study. I mean, you study the masters, I got heavily into Richie Blackmore, and I was the right age, I was 13, and, I was wearing all black. I just, not because I was a goth, but because I was really into Richie Blackmore, and he only wore black, so I'm going to get a black strap like Richie Blackmore. And, it's perfect. And something about Deep Purple that's funny. Very, very operatic. And, they had a huge influence. And when we recorded Hush, we just did it for like wasn't an exclusive kind of Christmas single, because we'd had a great year with Kay, and we'd had like four right. top 10, we'd had a number one album and four top 10 singles, and we just let's do something for the fans. Yeah, it'd be great, just a bit of fun, and it was turned into like a huge hit. And completely unexpected. And it was one of those songs that I'd listened to when I was at school, on my freak playlist.
Well, have you ever heard the Billy Joel Royal version? Familiar
with that? Yeah. I know it's.
Well, I wish somebody would work in that. I mean, the Deep Purple version is just a heavier song, and the groove is more powerful. But what I love about the Billy Joel Royal version, it's got that kind of swamp pop guitar riff. And I've just never heard anybody cover the song and incorporate that element into it.
Yeah, it's a really cool recording. We'd play it at gigs if we ever wanted to just, lift things up a bit. And so we were just thrashing it, we played it a lot faster than Deep Purple, but we had that, we had the guitar and the Hammond, and we just used to thrash it. And that's kind of, that was our approach to the recording. It's just, we just did what we did live.
Well, we got time to spin another track off of First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs. And I want us to lend an ear to Don't Forsake Me. What can you tell us about that cut?
It was one of those. I tell you what it was. It was actually born of guitar, that one, because I found a secondhand Epiphone SG just lying around for like £100 in a guitar shop near me, and I picked it up, and it just sounded really good, and it was really cheap, and I was, oh, I'll take this, and hopefully they won't notice that it's worth more. And I took it, and so I just wanted like a really heavy, like a motorbike riff, a riff uh-huh. to drive to Stonehenge, playing on your motorbike. That's why I came up with that, and so it was really a song to fit the guitar.
And what kind of what amp are you playing the guitar through?
I think I was just plugged into a little mm-hmm. Fender Junior Blues amp, like that my kid was using. And my kids are a huge influence on this album, because they were playing ukulele for a long time, and then they went electric, like it was like Dylan in 65, like all of a sudden there was this racket. And I had amps and drum kits and stuff in my home in the next door to the kitchen. And so I just started thrashing out with them. And that's really the cause of that track, especially.
Oh, very cool. Well, Crispian, thank you so much for chatting with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
My pleasure. Good to speak to you.
We're going to give a listen now to Don't Forsake Me off the album First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs. It's Coolest Shaker and Little Stevens Underground Garage. Shaker. That was some of Don't Forsake Me here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. The track is off the new album First Congregational Church of Eternal Love and Free Hugs. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to frontman Crispian Mills for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. The Underground Garage's Michael DeBar. He's got a new single out now on Wicked Cool Records called Ain't Nothing You Can Do About It. And on the recording, he's backed by LA's prima donna. And joining me to talk about the single and what else they're up to is Kevin Preston, the band's lead singer and guitarist. He's my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.